After the carriage left and dishes were washed and Lady Seymour was sound asleep, I started my free day, still trembling from Madam's threat. How could I get word to Corson that I couldn't bring food any longer? Would Dibdin let him starve if I stopped being his messenger? What if I ignored Madam's rule and continued to visit the Bridewell? I walked block after block pondering. I walked past the rope works and the brewery to the orchards on the east side, silent under the snow. I walked past houses that had letters G.R. George Rex carved into the front door, property stolen in the name of the king. Like Madam had carved her letters into my soul, burned the mark into my skin. She can do anything. I can do nothing. The ashes of sadness and the buzzing bees of my melancholy all spun a storm inside of me. And I walked and walked until my new shoes rubbed blisters all over my feet and the blisters popped. I took off the shoes and walked in the snow. Once my feet were frozen enough, the blisters didn't hurt. As the sun ran for the west, rowdy songs started up in the taverns and groggeries. I found myself on the shore of the North River just above the Battery. Empty rowboats were tied up to a wharf. As the tide pulled out to the ocean, they bobbed and bumped against each other. A few lights twinkled across the water in faraway New Jersey. I thought of all the ancestors waiting at the water's edge for their stolen children to come home. Waiting and waiting and waiting. A thought surfaced through my ashes. She cannot chain my soul. Yes, she could hurt me. She'd already done so. But what was one more beating, a flogging even? I would bleed or not, scar or not, live or not. But she could no longer harm Ruth, and she could not hurt my soul. Not unless I gave it to her. This was a new notion to me, and a curious one. A group of soldiers singing loud as they could swayed down the street, very muddy in drink. I hid in the shadows until they were gone, then headed back to Wall Street. I passed several houses filled with Christmas carols, joy to the world, and I saw three ships and the first Noel. A fat candle glowed on a parlor windowsill of a house on a corner, set there to guide someone home. The Lockton's and Lady Seymour were all retired for the night by the time I returned. The house was still empty of soldiers and their wives. I built up the fire in the hearth, set my shoes and damp stockings to dry in front of it, and rubbed a calendula salve on my blisters. Christmas, Mama's voice reminded. Keep Christmas. For the second time on the very same day, tears threatened. I rubbed them away and vowed not to cry again. 'Twas a nuisance. I found myself studying the loaf of bread on the table. A sharp knife showed up in my hand and the loaf was soon cut into fat slices. A chipped crockery bowl appeared from the pantry, alongside the butter and eggs and milk and the sugar loaf and the nutmeg grater and the small amber flask. I baked me a maple syrup bread pudding in the Rhode Island style. While it cooked, I cleaned myself up good and proper. I thought about stealing a piece of Madam's rose-scented soap, but that would have made me smell like her. I preferred to smell like strong lye. I washed my arms and legs and the back of my neck and my ears and my face, and I dried myself with a soft, clean rag. I frowned as I stepped back into my clothes. I'd grown some, and they didn't fit proper. I'd let out the seams of the bodice as much as I could and taken out the hem of the skirt. Much more growing, and I'd look a right scandal. But I wouldn't think on that now. I was trying to make a Christmas. I pulled on my dry stockings and stepped into my new shoes. Even though they rubbed fierce on the pop blisters, I put the bowl of bread pudding into a basket, tied on my cloak, and wound up my hands in rags to keep the frost from biting. I walked out the back door. It was not yet midnight, so in truth, 'twas still the day I could call my own. I set my path westward to the burnt-over district, to Canvas Town. The line where September's fire had stopped was sharp cut. First a house with no damage, next a house still bearing black streaks of soot and smoke, then a field of ruin, with makeshift hovels crafted from tent, brick, and scorched timbers. Rats nibbled on frozen garbage heaps. The smell of the fire still lingered, tainted with the smell of filth and decay. But in the bleakness, there were spots of hope. A wreath was stuck on the front of a tent. Children's clothes hung from a clothesline, stiff with ice, but still sweet-looking. A butter churn stood watch over a neat stack of fresh split wood. Smoke swirled slow from the top of a chimney, dipped at the roof line, then rose up to the stars. I lifted my face to the sky, and for the first time in much too long, I prayed. I prayed as hard as I could, without words or shapes or fancy talking. I just prayed. When I was done, I felt cleaner than I had after my bath. I walked on until I found a hut built against a lone brick wall. From inside came sounds of a family, the papa's low rumble, the mama's bright laugh, and giggling children who had been allowed to stay up much too late and who did not want to fall asleep. I greeted them through the piece of canvas that served as their front door. The hovel fell silent. Then the canvas was pushed aside, and the father stepped out, a musket in his hand. His wife came right behind him, though he told her to stay inside. It took some convincing to explain my mission, but I spoke polite and firm and held out the bread pudding. And the children snuck out in their nightclothes and just about dove into the bowl. The mother took the basket and said, "Thank you," and then "Thank you again," and then "Thank you most, most kindly," and they went back inside. I hummed a carol as I walked away, finally feeling at peace.